suffered
Waco
when they
burnt it
to the ground. Without me,
Oklahoma
wasn't
possible
at all.
See my silhouette
in the Super 8
around the
grassy knoll.
Everything you know is wrong.
Misinformation.
There's a virus missing out of this song.
Misinformation.
Everything you know is wrong.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. And we want to thank all our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of our programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the air room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the air room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio, KBOO 90.7.
How you doing?
I'm all right. Or that's an overstatement, but for the purposes. Yeah, all right, Merckx. Okay. And you?
I'm good. Yeah, I would say a little bit better than all right, but just work continues.
Sure.
We've been talking about it a lot. Ongoing projects. Sure. Things continue to come to the plate and leave the plate. It's a bit of a cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, the weather's nicening. It's interesting too. It hasn't just happened yet, but maybe I'm even late to the party. Kind of finals era is happening at college. So I'm going to be overwhelmed for sure, but one day at a time. And it's interesting as well. I'm recouping from many things, but in many ways also, recouping from putting this exhibition together, which for those listening, we are talking about Mapping the Pipeline as part of Policing Justice, which is currently on exhibition at PICA, Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, through May. And yeah, it was a heavy lift. And I've been talking to an artist friend of mine and given the lineup with Alfredo Yar and Sandy Rodriguez and Carrie Mae Weems and others, local heavy hitters, Cleo and Kay and Talton Davis and Don't Shoot PDX, I'm kind of the new kid on the block in that arena. And yeah, showing up with everything that got there and it's still happening, I'm still kind of managing aspects of that, was pretty exhausting. So yeah, definitely still recouping. But yeah, I think that the show has gotten some positive press. And again, just one day at a time.
100%. I mean, it's not only a big lift creating something for people to see and experience and show up to and all the effort that goes into that, but then once you engage with that community, that space, you have so much more afterwards, right? That work, it's only really a pilot to the work that follows up. And it should be. I mean, rightfully so. The goal is to create conversation and stimulate dialogue, and a successful outcome is when that happens. But feeding through that in the aftermath and onwards is also time consuming and exhausting, and you are and have been entrenched in that. But from what I've heard, the show has been really great thus far, and I've only seen some images because I'm on the other side of the country, but very excited to be there in person to experience it and see all of the work in real life, which is what we're talking about.
Yeah, it'll be nice to have you on the coast, and will be nice to be able to show you the exhibition. And as Buddy mentioned, we're getting ready to produce and record, I guess, subsequent is probably not the right word, but episodes of Tin Can Phone as part of the Mapping the Pipeline education series. And so for context, my contribution in collaboration with Blue to this exhibition was called Mapping the Pipeline, and it chronicles a map or something, where it is multiple maps, but it is not the entire roadmap, but pieces of a larger way of trying to understand this challenging issue through specifically charting two kind of incarceral facilities and four schools, three of which, King, Tubman, and Jefferson, are in the Alberta Albina region. So as part of this project, one of the sites has a stage and was always planned to host events, which is a part of my continuous following up of. So yeah, we're calling this the Mapping the Pipeline Education Series, and will happen on April 6th, which is this upcoming weekend, Saturday, at Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. That's on Hancock and Williams. And at 12:30, we'll be looking at the statistics behind Mapping the Pipeline with special guest Adrian Allerant and perhaps Lily Copenhagel, who both contribute statistics to how Mapping the Pipeline kind of is understood and has like some founding in some real data mind. And at 1:45, we'll be looking at student engagement at Jefferson, which one student is confirmed who I've actually been working with since he was in fifth grade, Zamaj, and we've worked together through his time to now being a freshman at Jefferson High. He also was a student at Tubman, so it's really kind of someone moving through this landscape. And he participated in the workshop supported by Molly Esteve of Brick Architecture, and they supported students learning SketchUp, and students produced houses that were models from the community, models of houses that are in the surrounding area of Jefferson High. Zamaj will be there to talk about these things, and perhaps we'll have a parent from the PTA to do an update on the Jefferson Modernization Project. And if they're not able to make it, I will provide some insight to viewers about that. There was just a recent update with that project, and it is like $140 million over budget or something absurd, and it may not be an issue, perhaps, if voters are like, sure. And even if it's not an issue, it does mean that the modernization has been pushed back several years from completion, and so all that will get covered. And at 3 p.m., we have Those We Remember. As part of Mapping the Pipeline, we have two folks who are being memorialized. Derek Clark, who was shot and killed by Clackamas County Police and is a Tigard former Albina resident. And so on behalf of Derek, we have his mother as a guest, Sarah Miles, who we've been working with to support this project and future projects. And then also Armand Pouspassand, who is a former Beaverton resident, and many folks who may be fans of the show might know Armand as one of the founders of this project. And for anyone who has or hasn't checked out the exhibition, there's a lot of audio that Armand is responsible for gathering that is a part of the Mapping the Pipeline project. And so representing or memorializing Armand, we have Laverne, who's Armand's grandmother, and former guest on the show. So that's the series. Again, that's 12:30, 1:45, and 3 p.m. for those individual slots. Feel free to come for one or come for all. And we'd love to see you. That's what we got going on this weekend.
There's also some programming. There's some films that are being shown at Clinton Street Theater. Information for that can be found on PICA's website. The series is going to be running from, it's been running from, you know, February 23rd and it goes all the way to May. That's the whole show. This specifically is a, it's called the Policing Justice Film Series. It features several documentaries, including Reimagining Safety, a 2023 film, as well as a few shorts, including Is Portland Dying? And then one that Tin Can Phone and Michael and collaborators have also been featured in, and that's Split Jury, which was released in the LA Times, which focuses in on Oregon's non-unanimous jury system, a tangential issue and piece of contextual history around Oregon and policing. So there's a number of films. I would encourage anyone listening to check out PICA's website for more details. But certainly Thursday, this coming Thursday, there will be a screening of several. And would love to see you all there, as well as at the exhibition on Saturday for the speaker series.
Yes, definitely an action-packed weekend for this project and franchise.
Yes. And yeah, just in a moment of transition here too, I just want to give flowers to you, Michael. Something that we've been talking about in the behind the scenes. You know, I feel a little bit helpless being so far away, and I know how much you're carrying and how much effort you've put into this project, both in like the physical moving of pieces and developing programming and organizing people. But something that definitely needs more acknowledging always is the mental toll and the emotional toll that this kind of work takes and the burden that you carry, because that just comes with the territory. It comes with carrying other people's experiences, their traumas, and that's ingrained into this kind of work. So I just wanted to take a brief moment and give my appreciation to you and also just, yeah, acknowledge the weight you're carrying, and you do so very gracefully.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I feel like in ways I have handled it with grace. And it's also, though, possible that I've been like numbing in order to carry it, perhaps. And, you know, I think it has indirectly taken a toll on like my personal life and personal relationships. And with kind of unrest in that space, I feel like my capacity to like do anything is pretty limited. I realize now in my current like state of relative shutdown that like finishing the exhibition was like all grit and like manic. And fortunately, like it was less clerical, and I really struggled in the clerical regions. But I also will kind of answer that with kind of gratitude. I think that the project never would have gotten off its feet without you in particular. So much of what is not seen but heard, some visual elements, but was really all you in the post-production sense. I mean, of course, Armand was involved and there was other folks involved, but preparing it and inserting it into the project was you. And then other collaborators, Blue, who did a lot of heavy lifting on the project, and Mariano as well, and his team at Jaja PDX. And, you know, Katie, who did a lot of the design work on the Derek's Diary component, and We Rise Media, and, you know, Sarah and others, Lily and Adrian. I know that there's names I've missed, but it was interesting when we did the opening, I called everyone up to the stage to just to be seen. You know, so much of my work, it's like I'm the figurehead of, and the way that I kind of reference myself as master artist Michael Bernard Stevenson Jr., it might imply, it is an implication more than it's some sort of hard reality, because so much of what I do is not monolithic or singular to me in any way, either from a subject or production aspect. And so I'm endlessly gratitudinal for you, and that I don't think I would really be anywhere without kind of the wind beneath my sails, so to speak. So, and that is even what, like at this point, there's like holes in my sails and rips and tears, but I still get blown along somehow and continue to be appreciated for that kind of team effort. So yeah, thank you for acknowledging me, and give yourself a pat on the back too. And I guess we'll be able to high five when you're on this coast.
Very much looking forward to it. Always am in deep appreciation of the collaboration, and was actually in this same vein, was reflecting a couple nights ago as we were prepping and having conversation about the programming coming up and the existing project and moving forward and all the things. five years at least with my involvement. And I think really like, you know, Tin Can Phone as its current state, we're, if not there, we're approaching that in the coming couple of months. I think it's summer of 2019 when we first met right before the world ended. And so, yeah, just spend a little bit of time reflecting on that anniversary and what has been and what has come from this, both directly and indirectly over the last 5 years. And it's really monumental. And, you know, as imperfect and as overbearing as this may be and feel at some points, this model and this work still remain, I mean, just as excited as I was, if not more, when we first made our encounter and started off down this road. So yeah, a little landmark there.
Yeah, no, it's true. And yeah, I mean, that moment was also a year or more after the initial recordings of Great American Stories. So I think it's interesting. I don't remember if we had actually, I don't think we like actually launched without you, Tin Can Phone, on platform. I vaguely remember like editing an episode myself, but that might be an artifacted memory. But yeah, it's really been a time. And I think it's interesting too, this series, the Mapping the Pipeline Education series, because I feel like, I guess you were in Oregon, but when we were recording, you were like getting ready to go to California and then you were in California. So like so much of this has been kind of not in the same geographic region. And it's interesting still, you know, with Armand having passed away and Joe's kind of estranged from the project and Quiz is still theoretically might be getting out of incarceration tomorrow or something.
Be part of the series, we'll see.
Yeah, that is totally true. So yeah, it's just interesting really continuing to try to hold it together. And yeah, again, I appreciate you being the steady force. I continue to say, though, I never know what I say means to people, because I'm an ever-present voice and the show just happens. And it's interesting with you becoming a voice and a presence, but the show would not have survived this long or might not have even happened were you not on the project. So again, thank you for that.
Likewise. And in the interest of brevity, on that same note, this coming week is going to be a fantastic opportunity. If on top of all the programming that we've mentioned prior to, I'm really excited to connect with people in the area. So if you are listening to this on Tuesday and are interested in any of the things that we have mentioned recently or in past, we are going to be around. So please, you know, use the channels and reach out to us. We'd love to speak more about further developments about the project or anything in tangent. And then this is not a full new episode. We have reserved the latter of the episode and our airtime, our monthly airtime on KBOO Community Radio, shout out KBOO always, to repurpose a little bit of material from last month where we interviewed Nina and Cleo.
Yeah, and the show remains up through May, so that content remains relevant. Come check out the exhibition, and there's some press in Oregon Arts Watch and Street Roots. So yeah, look us up and check us out. Thanks for listening in.
3 years in, 3 seasons in, I ain't talking that time. We were stuck in the pen, all the work they kept, all the work put in. Got it out the money, see the dirt on our hands. Pretty boy Poots had a dope ass plan. The recorder came in when Mike came in, so 10 can phone with contraband. Now you not, but still convicted. Damn, they did our brother wrong. 12 on the yard and he walked that off. Now Jaja's when he walk it out. Can't do pack like my cousin's house, but we ain't throwing hands, we talking it out. Bring it on blank, we at grandma's house. It's Mike, it's Joe, it's Poots, it's me. Wheels out there yelling, free BG. It's Mike, it's Blue, it's Misfit Queens. Buddy in the cut, that's perfect scene. 10 can phone, that's something to see. I didn't do it, so I preach in the street, still praising the hood. Like I didn't lose Queen, Moon, Ben, and Billy too. When it comes to the life shit, bro, I'm cool. So every picture I'm throwing up twos.
This is another episode of Tin Can Phone. We're welcoming guests Nina Amstutz and Cleo Davis, both curators of the Policing Justice exhibition, which just opened this past month at PICA, I guess just 2 weeks once this airs ago. And I, master artist Michael Bernard Stevenson Jr., was an artist in the exhibition curated in by Nina and Cleo to do a project about juvenile justice, in which much of the early recordings that have been very phantomly alluded to for the past 3 years are on exhibition, including a publication of excerpts from that, which we can get into. But let me welcome my guests, Nina and Cleo. Feel free to introduce yourselves and or share what a nice broad spectrum portrait of this exhibition was for you.
Well, I'll go ahead and introduce myself and then allow Nina, if she may, to give that broad perspective. My name is Cleo Davis. I am a resident, longtime resident, born here in Albina, and a longtime artist and designer who works in as a social construct artist. And I will pass it to Nina.
Thanks, Cleo, and thanks, Michael, for having us. So my name's Nina Astitz, as Michael said. I teach art history at the University of Oregon, and I'll tell you a little bit about, I guess, where the project came from and how Cleo and I kind of came into this collaboration as well. As probably most of our listeners will remember, I'm not sure if the listeners sort of extend beyond Portland or not for the Tin Can Phone.
It does.
It does. Awesome. Great. So, well, in any case, in 2020, really across the country, obviously, there was a tremendous outpouring of support for racial justice. And one of the things that was particularly hard to watch, I think, in that moment was the amount of police violence that those protests were met with. And in Portland, that was especially the case, perhaps more than anywhere in the country. Those protests had lasted longer, and they were met with so much violence, over 6,000 cases of documented use of force. And that is, you know, really a staggering number. And I think, you know, at least for me as a historian, I was extraordinarily struck by that. I always, you know, try and think about the present in relation to the past. And so it seemed like something that was really worth investigating, not just as sort of an isolated moment, but instead sort of pulling the thread backwards to really kind of understand how we got to this place. Usually that kind of expression of violence does not come out of nowhere, especially on a scale like that. And so really sort of unpacking the history of Oregon in terms of how it intersects with the history of policing nationally as well was sort of the basis for this exhibition. And I sort of initiated the project and then met Cleo along the way. And Cleo and I, we really started having these deep conversations about that history. And I think, you know, the sort of interesting thing about our collaboration is I'm coming at it as someone actually who grew up in Canada and moved to Oregon about 10 years ago. And Cleo, of course, as you mentioned, Cleo, you've been here quite a long time. Obviously, your family comes from here and you've moved away and come back. But having a kind of dialogue about our local history was a sort of important way of connecting with this community for me. And for you, obviously, a way of really thinking through, I imagine, the ways in which your practice as an artist can sort of activate and bring to life the history of this place. So I think that sort of gives a little introduction maybe of where the project comes from. And, you know, all the artists are really looking at that history from different perspectives. But maybe, I don't know, maybe Cleo, you want to jump in and sort of talk about it because you're a curator in this project and also an artist. And I think, you know, your project really speaks to the history of policing in the broadest terms, not just as a history of law enforcement and the violence that the community has experienced, our marginalized communities have experienced with respect to sort of policing in that direct sense, but also policing in a much broader sense.
Right. Yeah, so I think it was interesting because, you know, when we first initially talked, you know, I was brought on, the conversation was coming on as an artist under or around the spatial justice in policing. And so when you just look at how space and all things in that space, you know, it's broad. It's super broad. So I think with our artist team, where we were coming from, Base, our Black Aesthetic Studio, who actually, you know, as a group, we participated and did joint pieces, the three shipping containers that represent the mobility and the transport of the Black community as well as Black individual bodies. When looking at policing and space, it is just so broad. And one of the things that we wanted to really highlight that we thought would complement the overall exhibition is looking at past, present, and future. Whereas a lot of the information within the exhibition is looking at the past harms and the current harms. But begging that question of, you know, what does it look like for Black governance instead of Black policing now and in the future, and what does it take to get there?
That is like an interesting and unique look. And I'm curious, Cleo, since you're kind of on the topic, because the show itself has several unique approaches that, at least in our earliest conversations, I don't know if it was fully known how that might manifest. And I'm curious, Cleo, for you, where else you see in the exhibition unique approaches to trying to understand this concept?
Okay, when you say this concept, what is the this concept that you're speaking of?
I guess there's a couple ways to interpret it. One would be the premise of policing justice in the show at large. But the other way to approach it would be that, you know, not all of the work in the exhibition to me was so directly about policing, in how, you know, I did an interview as part of my work, and specifically at the Cottonwood Island. And it was kind of, it's really a beautiful interview. It's so innocent. It's with two boys who are actually students at Cottonwood. And I started by saying to them, I think we started with what is justice, which they like very quickly had an answer to. And then I said, what is policing? And then they were like, oh, I don't know if I know what that is. And so we unpack it, like, well, what is, like, I used run and running. And then they were like, police something. They were like, to protect it. But then when they like unpacked it, like the ICE building, and they're like, yeah, they're kicking them out and they're doing all this stuff. And I'm like, okay. And then like the gassing and the protesters are fighting for their justice, but then the police are like fighting them with toxic chemicals. And then so we revisited policing and they're like, yeah, you know what? That doesn't sound so great. And so like that, even, yeah, so there's just like an analogy for a unique, what were the, because you described your own unique approach to thinking about policing of space. What were other ways that you felt like that showed up in the exhibition?
Well, the thing is maybe I shouldn't have said unique, because I feel like the whole exhibition itself is one whole unique, cohesive approach. What I was meaning to say about our pieces, and you know, I jumped in talking about pieces, that basically it was a way of to me, it synthesizes a lot of the stuff that we're communicating. A lot of the pieces are communicating multiple aspects of what it means to have your liberation violated. And so the approach that we were looking at is, how do we move from those violations to the repairing of our liberation? I don't really mean that our piece is like unique in any other way, that the whole thing is unique.
I feel like I want to say something about just curating this with Cleo, because I feel like kind of what you're getting at, Michael, is something that our collaboration certainly expanded my perspective on. And, you know, Cleo and I, in our conversations about what policing means, right, in the Black community or in other marginalized communities, it's not just about violence, I guess. That's just sort of the most extreme manifestation of enforcement. And I feel like, you know, through our conversations, at least Cleo, you really helped me see that policing also manifests in the ways that the mind is policed, the ways that creativity is policed, the way that the body is policed. And all of those sort of forms of policing, I think, are somehow represented or explored in the exhibition in different ways. Some of them may be subtle, some of them very direct. But certainly, I think the local projects were all very self-determined. And so that kind of self-determined process of engaging the community in the creation of those projects, and having each sort of artist, obviously, you know, we started with sort of three artists with the commissions, and then those artists sort of went from there, engaging whoever they felt were the best collaborators for their project. But I think that that dimension of the project as well sort of speaks to this sort of expanded way of thinking beyond policing, I guess.
And that's a part of what I'm trying to get at for Cleo, and we'll, I guess, lay it out for all of us, but for Cleo in particular. You're not just in an intellectual conversation with us about what we know, but we're doing a bit of a performance for the listener who may not have been to the show or seen anything, or someone who has been to the show but doesn't have the insight that you can provide. So when I said unique, I wasn't trying to say that you were trying to say that you're setting yourself apart. I was setting you up to describe something that wasn't your own project that the listener may benefit from your take on it.
Yeah, let me see. How do I respond to that? Because I'm interested in responding to the whole thing that just happened right now. What Nina chimed in to say, if I don't answer it within this or discuss it within this, and you can remind me and revisit it. But for me, I guess when we talk about the uniqueness of this, you spoke about when you were speaking with the youth about what is policing. So for me, the whole time I've been thinking about it from the last 2 years that we've been working on this exhibition. And the majority, how I break down policing, right, in my mind, and it touches on a lot of the things that Nina just spoke about. The majority of what we're talking about in or expressing, all of us, in the exhibition is really enforcement to me, not necessarily the policing. It starts with the policing. And for me, policing and policy are different words of the same coin. So a lot of this, what I was saying in my, you know, the uniqueness was, how do we look at the policing not just at the means of enforcement. So I felt like the exhibition is really heavy. It's really heavy and intense, especially, you know, like if you walk, when you walk around and then you go to Alfredo Jarre's exhibit, man, that one on the, just the scale alone and the sound, I mean, you're like there, it's jarring. So there was that futuristic piece to me, gives some type of hope of where do we go from here? You know, it gives folks the ability to come up with answers, not to just be jarred with the sheer enforcement of it all. But I mean, I had no idea that this exhibition would move me like it did.
Mm.
You know, thank you, Nina, and all the artists who helped put this together. It's amazing to me to be a part of something this impactful. Very important for me as an artist to do work that's impactful and that moves the dial, and to be a part of a group, a collaboration that has achieved this, and with the spirit and how it moves you emotionally, intellectually, even spiritually. So I just want to say thanks, Michael. Thanks, Nina. This is super dope to me.
I want to, you know, reiterate that. Thank you, Cleo, as well. And thank you, Michael, because I, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about sort of this response, especially from some of the folks at Jefferson. And you know, my initial instinct is, oh, that's, you know, we want to be talking in this exhibition to a really broad audience, right? And so it feels kind of like a bummer, you know, that folks are disappointed by that. But I think I want to emphasize, you know, what Cleo is just saying, that art isn't always meant to make you comfortable, right? And I think that's really where it has its power, is in the ways in which it can speak to truth. Sometimes, you know, as a historian, I feel like we spend a lot of our time writing books that are really dry, that nobody reads, and the impact of them sometimes is great and sometimes it's very limited. And I do feel like, you know, especially the artists that have participated in this show, they're really able to activate history. I mean, all of you are historians and educators, and you work with historical documents in a way that brings them to life and makes them real and tangible in ways that is really difficult, honestly, as a historian or as an academic. And that's sort of where I feel that, you know, the discomfort is worthwhile. And that doesn't mean that the end message of the show is that, yes, everything's terrible. It's more that we have to look at history in order to understand the present, in order to do better in the future. Because, you know, as you were saying, Michael, it's not just one suspension, right? It's when you start looking at those statistics and really thinking about that, right? That you start to see patterns that are systemic and that have long roots, and to disrupt those patterns involves recognizing those roots. And so I absolutely agree. The exhibition is in a way devastating, right? But I think the ways in which, in particular, it centers Liv's experience, or at least that's the goal, is to create a space in which it isn't always the sort of institutional narrative that is dominant, where everyone with lived experience is sort of screaming and shouting and saying, hey, this is not my experience, but instead, that is the experience that's dominant. I think that, you know, policing maybe is sometimes the most direct way in which we experience the sort of authority of institutional narratives. Police, at least with respect to crime or, you know, violence committed by the police, or it doesn't even matter if it's by the police, it's them that writes that narrative, right? They write their report. They're the one that releases that to the media. The media then tells that story however the police have told that story. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always align, right, with the lived experience.
I don't know if it ever does.
Ever, exactly. And it doesn't matter sometimes how much the community or victims shout into the ether about what actually happened. Once that narrative is out there, it's always them against the narrative, right? And, you know, with this exhibition, we really tried to create a space in which people with lived experience don't have to fight to tell that narrative. It is the dominant narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, sometimes it's a devastating narrative. Obviously, this exhibition tells a lot of really, really difficult stories. But yeah, I personally think it's important for us as a society to just sit in the discomfort sometimes. And I think that exhibition does that. It gives us the space to do that without the threat of violence, hopefully. That's the point, while also ultimately having a lot of, or creating a lot of space to imagine a different future, especially when our policymakers aren't really able to institute that future for us, right? I mean, art is able to push the envelope in that respect, even if it feels idealistic to say, oh, you know, all these artists imagining a better future, what does that ultimately have to do with reality? Or how is that going to impact reality? Well, I do think it's through the creative imagining that ideas become normalized.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, some of the things you're thinking about, it's funny, again, because I was just at this, like, Black-owned gallery. Of course, I would say the name, but I don't know how to pronounce it, but I can spell it. I think it's like La'afa, which Ivan is the proprietor of this gallery, and they were formerly a Timbers soccer player. And the show on exhibition right now is called Scene, and it's like about feeling and being seen. And I had referenced this earlier when I was a young artist, a lot of my work was like dealing with race and like was really focused on like issues of concern and how to like just show that them or something, to point at it. And then, I mean, that's kind of when we had our first conversations. I was like, yeah, well, pointing at stuff isn't that interesting to me anymore. I want to like do something. And that's what all my work is about. Though in some ways, it's kind of like maybe a plein air painting practice. Like, I enjoy making objects that point at stuff. It's like fun to do and to talk about. I just don't feel like it does what I need my work to be doing. And this project was an interesting example to maybe do both. But I agree that, yeah, I think, because when you were talking about sitting in discomfort, I was, for some reason, like Rodney King popped into mind, which this is like weirder time. And I guess for anyone who happens to not be aware of that or too young, or is that, Cleo, was it like 93 or something, or it was in the 90s?
Yeah, it's around,
I want to say
93.
If it's,
I was just reading about this in my class because we read an article by Elizabeth Alexander, sort of talks about images of Black violence that centers around Rodney King, but I can't remember the exact date either, but I think you might be right, Michael.
Let's see. I'm looking it up, but 91, it seems. Yep. So close. But is also interesting because I don't know why I was looking it up recently, but Rodney King, well, let me not get ahead of myself. So for those of you who are not aware, this is what the internet says, was an African-American man who was a victim of police brutality, which is amusingly light, on March 3rd, 1991, he was severely beaten by officers of Los Angeles Police Department during his arrest after a high-speed pursuit for driving while intoxicated on the I-210, which there was also then, like, after this, and this, I mean, I don't know why I even know everything that I know, but it was recorded by, like, some weird white guy who was, like, not recording it as a pro-Rodney King position, per se, but then sold the tape, was maybe, like, doing it to sell. And then it's funny too, because, or not funny, but he was then like upset that after it went super viral, that he was like, oh, I should have got more for it, or some weird perspective. And so, yeah, that time, as I was thinking about it while you were talking, it's like that time, it's, I don't know that we're like safer now, but there is, like, you know, between then and George Floyd, to try to like conflate those moments and time, we're still there or something, you know, or it's worse or something. And so I don't think just being like, well, what if we have more school programs? Like, and here I am making school programs. I'm not just, and I think, you know, that happens, right? Like, I made a camp called Fred Hampton Summer Camp, and, you know, PPS, it was a funder. And so when you tell them the information, they put it in their catalog. And like immediately I have white parents like reaching out to me like, this sounds super cool. Can my kid come? And I'm like, well, I need time, because the goal is that I'm able to serve young people in this community, and information travels differently and at different speeds, and there's different levels of capacity and preparedness to be getting your kid in a program. And so, you know, I'm really trying to work with certain students and certain young people to create a very specific context. And I think that, and even part of the subject matter of that camp is we talk about the murder of Fred Hampton. And part of the goal is to get folks aware and prepared and ahead of the conversation, but it is also like sitting in some sense of discomfort. Like these aren't, I mean, even the study of Martin Luther King or Malcolm X is in some ways a kind of like morbid meditation that, I'm trying to think, it's like, you know, because when you study, I don't know if this is getting more on topic or off topic. So I recently had an event at Reed where it was called Malcolm X Revisited, and, you know, a shared mentor of Cleo and mine is Mr. Kent Ford, founder of the Black Panther Party in Portland, who, when I get to PSU and to polish my bronze, will join the exhibition at this time. And Kent, in his hilarity, he's like, did you polish the statue yet, Michael? And I'm like, not yet. I'm working on it. And then I felt like Cleo, where like now he's always asking about the stuff I didn't finish. I'm like, oh, I'm coming. But we did this event and we watched the scene in Spike Lee's film about his life where he's shot and killed. And I got shared an article from Chisao Hata, who is a Japanese American activist in Portland, who knew Yuri Kochiyama, who, for those who don't know, was at the scene of Malcolm X's assassination and is seen pictured in Life magazine cradling his head. And in the Spike Lee film, it's his wife. And one of the reasons we were looking at all this was to kind of call out this oversight in the telling of the story and the invisibilization of Yuri Kochiyama. So anyway, so we're watching the clip in this session with like 80 or 40 people present. And it was so fascinating to me. It's not surprising, but it's like tender and curious. In the scene where Malcolm X starts getting assassinated, Kent like turns away and like won't look at it. And you could sense the discomfort of just the sound of guns firing and people screaming. And so when I say it's like a morbid meditation, it's like Kent will talk to you about Malcolm all day. But to talk about Malcolm is also to talk about how his views were so challenging to the status quo, such that he was assassinated for those views. And so if we're talking about shifting the status quo, I don't know if it's like, hey, like, I think we're in a utopia, let's make it better. Like, we're not in a utopia, and the making it better is related to shifting the issues that we see. Cleo and I were talking kind of before the recording about building new systems. And like, I don't know how you do that work without analyzing the parts of it that are not working. Like, the school to prison pipeline isn't because every Black student excels brilliantly out of the school and then somehow ends up in prison. It's because we're looking at, they're dealing with suspension and other things from grade school. And some of the other plaques talk about like child welfare and all these other things, and they stack up. And when we're looking at displacement, right? So when we talk, when Cleo's talking about spatial justice, and we're talking about folks who aren't able to keep up with the rising cost, and they have to move out of the community. And some of those folks who moved out of the community are still attending Jefferson, but just the emotional and energetic drain of commuting all the way across town to be connected to your cultural and heritage legacy. And so I think it's unfortunate, and I hope to kind of be able to keep this conversation alive with the folks who were disappointed. But in a way, I am in conversation with the community. As mentioned, I have a meeting later today at Jefferson to talk about, you know, maintaining the historical legacy and archiving. And I think these things are related, but they're hard to see when you're looking at an artwork to see all of the pieces. But yeah.
If I can jump in there real quick, Michael, you know, to me, now all those things that you talked about, that brings up, that is all policing. And so when we're talking about like changing the system, I firmly believe that it's not always about modifying or reforming the current system, is that we need to create new systems for ourselves.
Yes.
That's the beauty of art and artists, is the creation of systems and processes and different ways of doing things and looking at things. So when we're talking about suspension, and this is one that always got me, because the education system is really, really nuts when it comes to Black folks and those who are constantly marginalized. It always threw me off, you know, just when I was a little guy, and, you know, we have a community that is fighting. We're fighting a people who have been truly against us, you know, as a group and as an institution. We're saying that we need to show you how to teach our babies and how to do that in the proper, most healthy manner. So that always threw me off that we would enter or maintain in a system that is unhealthy and detrimental to us individually and collectively, and fight and try to teach others how to treat us when we can just take our ball and go home and do that amongst ourselves, you know, i.e. charter schools, homeschooling, all different things that Noni with Beam at Beam Village is working on. And so when we do that, that's showing, when we stay in a system, that's showing how chains and shackles of policing are still locked to our minds and spirits. So, I mean, like, to me, policing is so broad, especially when we talk about within space and time. So, I mean, that excites me, that whole piece all the way, talking about Yuri Kochiyama, who was actually Malcolm X's best friend.
Yeah.
He's come to Oregon a few times, but yeah, I opened the floor back up. I'm done with my two cents. That was inspiring.
I mean, it's interesting because that was the first in a series that is happening at Reed and is more kind of indicative of the work that I do and I'm interested in. And it's funny because I don't know that I even included this. I might have breezed over it since we're all in the know. But I mean, maybe I mentioned it briefly, but I'll say it this way. I tried to do projects with all of the schools, and it is likely that I will work with Cottonwood, though there is presence, youth presence from that. And Cottonwood is actually really excited, and it may be, I think part of it is the ethos of the school. Like, they kind of got like beat by the police and they're like, we're going to fight you. And like, you know, conversation about this doesn't scare us. We're like ready to engage this. And I think that there's a lot of trauma in the King Tubman Jefferson worlds because those schools are all like also kind of getting beaten down. They're not getting supported by the larger institution. I mean, in the very recent past, they tried to move Tubman and eclipse King. And like part of the piece for me and, you know, the 3D model in the Jefferson piece is a part of this conversation that is amusing. They couldn't. Bora had trouble finding the file, and it took me until recently where I realized they don't even really need the 3D model anymore because ultimately they're demolishing the building and it's not a consideration like what its manifestation is. And to me, that is devastating. And I'm not even from here, and I mentioned it in the panel, but part of my relationship to this is like my dad has a very deep and rich historical legacy with the high school that he went to, but I went to the new school, right? And I just am disconnected from that. There isn't really a system for being connected to it anyway, but I'm not even connected it like via same alma mater or whatever. And so that fact that this exists at Jefferson is super beautiful to me. But I think it's also like lost to the students. And there's ways in which like the community is celebrating it in an ideological way, but it's not tangibilized. Like, I'm not sitting with the students in a way where they actually feel enriched because that's real for them. And so we've done different workshops last year, but this year so far, we did a workshop where students toured the neighborhood and took pictures of houses adjacent to the school and then learned 3D modeling software, SketchUp, to create 3D models. And those 3D models were then printed and included in the exhibition. And so again, in my email response to this expressed concern, I said, look, like it's subtle, but there's actually more elements on the table that are positive, but there's no plaque that says like the students made these or whatever. It's like part of the story of the artwork, hence like a contemporary art. And it's in the materials description. You know, again, it's subtle in a way that you have to actually look more deeply. And it's also true of the issue and concern. And the nature of my work is to like take these disparate elements, right? Like Kent turned away from the murder of Malcolm X. However, all of the rich stories that came in the room from Kent and Chisao, and then the participants did a story share. And we're getting ready to do a dinner event because faculty or their staff and their alumni of Reed was at the event. And they're like, this was super cool. Like, we want to do another thing. And so these are the kind of kernels that by looking at the doing this morbid meditation, it kind of creates an opportunity in which to transport oneself to this utopian pop in the future that I think as an American society, as a state, as a species, we're in this form of critical denial. And, you know, I've had some folks quote to me that, like, well, actually, statistically, we're in the safest, healthiest era of human existence. But I think, like, in the growth of empathy or whatever, even having the capacity to be upset about it, it's not good enough, right? Like, you know, no Rodney Kings on my watch, you know, and here we have, you know, with George Floyd. And that's what I think Portland really rose up to say, like, not on our watch. And hopefully it continues. I don't know what the future will hold. I guess maybe as we kind of like close out on our time, though, I'm also realizing how much more of this digging in we can do in the coming months. But sitting now kind of on the precipice without even fully consuming the whole exhibition, what do you hope? And then maybe we can really close out with like a list of dates and times for upcoming stuff. But what do you really hope can come of this now that it exists and is tangible and can be perceived as a thing in which things are coming from?
Gosh, you know, it's a huge question because it always feels ambitious for an art exhibition to do more than simply be a statement or express some truth. But maybe I can just go back to what you were saying about the ways in which Portland sort of really came together and galvanized in 2020 and why that's so meaningful. I mean, I think for me, you know, one thing that I have gone through sort of over the course of this exhibition is I actually became an American citizen. Mm. I naturalized in September, actually, just of 2023. And I immigrated 5 years before, I guess. So, I don't know, 2018 or something like that. And it was a weird time, I'll just say, to immigrate to America. The politics were obviously pretty dark and still are in many respects. And I felt like up until that point, I was always sort of like, wow, you know, this is not my politics. This is not my history. You know, I fundamentally disagree with so many things that are happening here. And it left me sort of really unsettled in terms of where I fit in. I immigrated from Canada just for the audience, which is not that far away, but does really have a pretty different politics and attitude toward social programs and things like that. And the social safety net. But, you know, in the process of making this, and I feel like, or working on this project, and I feel like it's maybe only become clear to me why it was so important, for me at least, to work on this, that only sort of unfolded to me maybe more recently, is that I realized that to become an American, I needed to really sort of put myself maybe in the middle of it, in the discomfort, rather than just sort of disavowing it. And that meant sort of really grappling with the history of this country and becoming a real part of this community in whatever way that might manifest in terms of that particular history, that situated history. And so yeah, I think that I hope that at least what came out of 2020 for many people is something similar, right? It manifests surely in different ways for different people. For me, it manifested in terms of, you know, wanting to make this exhibition, right? And really sort of understanding this place and how it might be a better place if I'm going to participate in the democracy here, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that in many ways that has. I mean, there are so many incredible organizations and initiatives that have come out of 2020 that are working towards building better systems. And there's a lot of pushback against those systems, absolutely. I mean, just 2 days ago, the Portland Police Association released a press release announcing that they are initiating 2 ballot initiatives that seek to sort of dramatically rein in a ballot initiative from 2020 here that set up the Police Accountability Commission, among other things. And so that's really disappointing to see that change that our community wanted, and in that case, voted for with over 80% support, is now being sort of actively undermined before it can even be realized. But, you know, we have the opportunity, especially this year in 2024, to cast our ballot again. And I do think that the more people learn about our history, the more people sort of grapple with it and sit in the discomfort, that the more potential there is for us to, yeah, push back against that resistance to change, I guess. And perhaps that is a tall order for an exhibition, but I would just emphasize that it's not just the exhibition. This exhibition is very much meant to be one platform for dialogue. It's meant to be there to support people who are very active in the community in terms of seeking to change those systems, whether it's through policy or legal action or other forms of community advocacy. It doesn't stand alone. It's part of a larger conversation, and it's meant to support those conversations. And so that's what I would, I guess, leave with. We, you know, I think Cleo and I can probably both agree, we hope that this exhibition is something that the community takes ownership of on some level, and that, you know, it's out there now and
for sure
can do its work, whatever that may be, and that'll be different for different people.
Cleo?
You know, yeah, so for me, I think it's just use a few words, because, you know, thinking about this for the last 2 years and then actually, you know, put on the ground, being involved, you know, you get to see all of this work come to fruition, but you also get to experience the emotions and the emotions that others share as it pertains to the exhibition. But, you know, the night before the exhibition opened, we had that dinner and had a really interesting conversation with Teresa. And out of that conversation came that, you know, within our community, if we just took care of each other. And so, like, that, I think, just simply said, without using a bunch of different terminology and isms and things of that nature, it just really made me think that that's pretty much what my work, my wife's work, our work together is really about. Is like, when we talk about create an impact, or we talk about changing systems or creating systems, we just really want to take care of each other, or to be taken care of, and to be able to not only be taken care of, but take care of our neighbors. I just hope in some form that that's what we see. That's what I see in this, is that you see, you know, pain, you see folks being harmed and hurt, and you see, you know, those, you know, some of the footage of the protesters, you know, talking to the law enforcement, you know, basically, you know, as folks are being harmed and, you know, questioning their humanity. All in all, I hope that we walk away from this, or take with us from this exhibition, that compassion, care for one another, and whatever that means, if it means, you know, protection, financial resources, whatever it means, but we need to, that's what I really hope that we take away from this. And all that stemmed from that night. You know, I was thinking on a more complex level of expressing that, but it's just as simple as we need to take care, watch out for one another.
Yeah, I love that that sentiment kind of arose. I think also thinking about the pre-show conversation of whether or not to include a disclaimer and other things that, you know, I think why we were selected and what kind of conversation can happen, that kind of like simple but deep wisdom can arise. And again, through this work and the exercise of like thinking about it and processing it in the way that we are, again, this kind of morbid meditation. So I'm really glad that that came up and that we're getting the opportunity to do that. And as I get more and more entrenched in Portland politics, how much more and more it's going to need some of this alternative system building. I want to tack on to the end here that the Friday of this week, meaning of air, because it's next Friday, right? The 8th, am I tripping? Yeah. So there's a symposium, Policing in Portland, a Community Conversation at PSU that starts at 6 p.m. on the 8th, as well as Policing in Portland Community Conversation occurring on March 9th from 12 to 6. And then also the Thursday before that at 7 p.m. at Clinton Street Theater, Reimagining Safety and other shorts, as well as other films and shorts through on March 21st, April 4th, and April 18th. All this information is available on the PICO website. Your very own Tin Can Phone will be producing a series of events at PICA. Be on the lookout for that. Any final thoughts from either of you?
No, just thanks so much, Michael. This was a really nice conversation, and look forward to seeing you in the space, doing all the work that you do.
Thank you. I appreciate
thank you very much
for the opportunity as well, both for this conversation and to participate in this larger project. Looking forward to all that might come of it. Until next we meet.
You're listening to the Tin Can Phone podcast here at KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Listen every single first Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. or you can stream this at kboo.fm/tincanphone. Tune in at kboo.fm or 90.7 FM for more show.
Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills